All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. I tell you, I used to tell people that I loved playing this song. That's why I had it as my theme song. And it's Let There Be Drums, Sandy Nelson. And I used to say, you know what? It electrifies me in the morning. But you know what I realized? Really what I do is I get up, I work around, and I plan to get here on time. And it's not that I leave my house at a time where I would be guaranteed to be late. But what I do is I leave at just enough time so that if one or two things go wrong, I'm screwed, you know? So anyway, and that sets me on edge. So by the time I come in here, I'm ready to just kind of roar through it, all right? So this is, I won't calm down for the next hour or two, all right? So as my voice gets lower and lower. Anyway, we got a packed show today, so I'm going to stop screwing around and talk with you about what's going on, all right? At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with two of the actors and performers at the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess. They're going to be joining us in studio. It's Alicia Hall Moran, who plays Bess, and Kingsley Leggs, who plays Sport and Life. So stay tuned for that one. I saw the performance the other night. It's really knocks you out. But opening the show up, I've been waiting for quite some time to have the chance to talk with the people I'm about to talk to now. Back in 2013, at Sundance 2013, the first film I saw when I got to the festival there was Who is Diane Cristal? Well, let me give you a little bit of a taste about what this film is, all right? Because this is the trailer for the film Who is Diane Cristal?
These people, as much as they are invisible in life, they're invisible in death. It's very hard to identify them. Nobody's out there searching for them.
Diane Cristal was definitely an atypical case.
Who's this person? We don't have any report of somebody who was missing that had those tattoos. We're trying to see if somebody knows this person and try to ID them.
En vida era considerado invisible, un ilegal. Ahora en la muerte es un misterio por resolver. Nunca podré entender la dimensión de los peligros que enfrentó. Solo puedo tratar de recorrer sus pasos.
People sneaking across the border. To my mind, the problem is all economic. The American capitalist economy needs blue-collar labor.
For me, it's very frustrating knowing that somebody had a dream, but they ended up being a number, a statistic.
And once again, that was the trailer from the film Who is Diane Cristal? And like I said, when I first saw that back at the 2013 Sundance Film Festival, I was just knocked back in my seat.
It was an incredible piece of work. It was one that just left us just stunned, angry, inspired by the people that we saw in the film and really wanting to get it out. You know, just to give you a sense of this is something, I don't know who wrote this, but it's really good as a description. So I'll read it and then we'll jump into the discussion. It's deep in the sun-blistered Sonora Desert beneath a cicada tree. Arizona border police discovered a decomposing male body. Lifting a tattered t-shirt, they expose a tattoo that reads Diane Cristal. Who is this person? What brought him here? How did he die? And who or what is Diane Cristal? Following a team of dedicated staff from the Pima County Morgue in Arizona, director Mark Silver seeks to answer these questions and give this anonymous man an identity. As the forensic investigation unfolds, actor and activist Gael Garcia Bernal retraces this man's steps along the migrant trail in Central America. Joining us to talk about all this today is Mark Silver, the director of the film, and Robin Reinecke, a cultural anthropologist who appears in the film, and she's executive director of the Colibri Center for Human Rights. And I'm really happy to have both of them on the show today. Folks, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Okay. I think what I'll do is I'll start with you, Mark. I wanted, you know, as I said, I've watched this film. I saw it at Sundance. I've seen it two more times since then. And I'm always very, very moved by this. And it's, you know, I want to make sure that it gets out to the biggest audience possible. What compelled you to make this film?
Well, what happened originally was about 5 years ago in London, we launched a website that asked people to send in stories of resistance against wars and division between rich and poor and economic barriers. And one of the most compelling things that we read on the site was this story of unidentified skulls and skeletons being found in this epic desert landscape. And we saw an image of one of the search and rescue police holding a skull. And from that point, we asked ourselves, I wonder what a skull can reveal to you about the bigger systemic issues of migration and economics.
Now, this film, I mean, it's very heavy because it's unique in a lot of different ways. But something that it really captures is what's at the heart of life for millions of undocumented immigrants in the U.S. today, that in some ways, in many ways, in most ways, they're forced to live an almost invisible existence inside the U.S., while at the same time, they're everywhere. I mean, anything you see that needs to be done, anything that involves the basic functioning of society, invariably, you're going to find a work team of immigrants doing it, and a lot of them oftentimes undocumented. How did that contradiction play out in your head?
To be honest, we wanted to focus more on the journey that people make and the dangers of the border and how the border was designed to actually be dangerous. So our version of looking at the invisibility issue was more about the invisibility of the dead. It's obviously an epic human rights issue, and particularly at the moment where the immigration reform bill or compensation seems to be discussing this kind of trade-off between the giving documentation to 12 million people, but only if we increase security and surveillance, et cetera, at the border. And we felt that the part that was missing from that conversation, and hence invisible, was the fact that there's a direct relationship between increased border security and the number of deaths on the border. That was the thing that we wanted to bring visibility to.
Mm-hmm. It must be a fairly heavy thing to, one, try and find out the way into that story, though, because it's sort of like, you know, it can be so overwhelming. It's so, and again, as you're saying, it can be so hidden as well. I mean, even if it becomes just a statistic, but people aren't aware. I mean, look, I wasn't aware, even though I knew that there were people who were going out and leaving water under bushes and things like this. And there were all kinds of people doing things along in these areas that are known pathways for migrants coming into the U.S. But still, the question of like so many dead, and how do you carve into something that big?
Yeah, absolutely. And also something that's so visceral when you present it visually. So we basically embedded ourselves with the search and rescue teams and the people that work at the medical examiner's office in the hope that we would be able to track a body from the moment of discovery all the way through the forensic identification process, and then hopefully all the way back to a family. And as Robin can attest to, the statistics to make that happen were against us. I think quite a few people had tried that before. We followed several cases. I was there when the police discovered different bodies and skeletal remains over the course of, I think, four to 6 weeks. And the Diani Cristal body, we were very, very fortunate in that his family was identified in a relatively short amount of time, within about 3 months of him being discovered, whereas I think up to 700 of the 2,000 bodies that have been brought into that particular medical examiner's office are still yet to be identified.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Mark Silver, the director of Who is Diani Cristal, and Robin Reinecke, the executive director of the Calibri Center for Human Rights. Well, let me bring Robin into the interview right now. And Robin, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Yeah, good. Good to hear your voice, and really glad you could be here. And first, let me find out from you right away, is what is the Calibri Center?
The Calibri Center for Human Rights was actually developed very recently out of the work portrayed in the film as the Missing Migrant Project. So our work starts with the desire to help families in their search for missing people, and really we're building the biggest database of unfortunately missing migrants last seen crossing into the U.S.-Mexico area. And we're comparing that data against unidentified remains cataloged by offices like the Pima County Office of the Medical Examiner. And then on top of that, we are trying to reach a broader audience and really tell the story of what's happening and produce research and data. Unfortunately, a lot of the conversation about immigration reform and the border is not fact-based, not based on evidence and history. So we're really taking the issue of the very severe human rights crisis of the loss of life and the disappearance of thousands of people on the border to shine a bright light on the failings of our current immigration policy.
Now, is that related to what compelled you to want to be part of this film? I mean, if Mark showed up to you and said, hey, I want you to do this film with me, what compelled you to say, yeah, I need to be part of this?
Mark started visiting the medical examiner's office in 2009, and I remember when he first came into my office, but I think we started talking just immediately for like 4 or 5 hours. We had a lot to talk about. I think the framework that Mark was using at that time even to approach the story was really looking at broad structural factors looking at it with a human lens, but asking some of the more challenging philosophical questions about why are people coming? Why are they willing to come? Why are they willing to risk their lives? What's happening with the families? What's happening to the bodies? How is this going on for so long? I mean, at that time, in 2009, there had already been a decade of deaths in the hundreds per year, and still silence in terms of changing policy. So I was immediately very taken with Mark's approach, and I felt excited to work with him from the beginning.
Well, let's talk about this a little bit, because you also have a sense of just how serious the situation is, that it's not just a few people here and there, but it's actually a very large question. It's a very mass question, and it's something that not too many people are really all that acutely aware of.
Yeah, it's fascinating that people aren't aware of it. It's one of the things anthropologically that I'm interested in is how effective this discourse of illegality has been, that one of the most serious human rights crises is passing invisible. And in terms of, you know, talking about visibility and invisibility, I think that's one of the most interesting questions. 6,000 people have died in the last decade attempting to cross the border, and that number is believed to be quite low. It's a Border Patrol count, and Border Patrol is not always involved in the recovery of remains. It's really outside of their purview. So in the film, it's the sheriff's office. It's many, many other agencies that are involved in that process. So the 6,000 number is believed to be quite low. There's a lot of decentralization in terms of counting, many reasons why that number is low. 2,000 people are missing and 6,000 known to be dead. So that number already is more than 40 times more deadly than the Berlin Wall was in its entire existence.
I'm going to go back to Mark in a minute, but I want to ask you something, because Mark had mentioned that you could actually talk about statistically how high the odds are against what you're trying to do. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. This is really why the Colibri Center for Human Rights needs to exist. Remains are found in Arizona, in southern Arizona, where the film takes place, at least the part of the film relating to the decedent. In southern Arizona, 165 remains on average per year are discovered in the desert. They're discovered in various states of decomposition, so it's very difficult scientifically to identify them. And it's rare for certain clues to be present on the body. After even several days in the desert, someone is unrecognizable. So you already have environmental, structural reasons on the biological side that challenge identification. But then there's kind of complex political issues that make it even more complicated. Right now, only about 65% of the remains are identified every year. So that remainder of 35%, it accumulates. And right now, if you count from 1990 to the present, there's about 900 unidentified remains, making Arizona the third highest state for unidentified remains, following California and New York. So there's the biological issues, and then there's really structural issues. The families are sort of perpetually on the wrong side of the wall. They face challenges in following the kind of traditional procedure for reporting a missing person. So they can't call police, or police won't take their report. There's massive decentralization. They could report to Southern Texas for a missing persons case, and the body could be found in Arizona. So there are massive structural reasons preventing a higher success rate. We have the science. We have the technology. It's really political will and the use of this technology for this issue that we're up against. And that's why Colibri developed.
Huh. All right. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Mark Silver, the director of Who is Diane Kristal, and Robin Reinecke, the executive director of the Colibri Center for Human Rights. Mark, I want to ask you this. You have a film here that is not just, as we're talking, I'm thinking it runs up against the contradiction that you spoke to in terms of how you actually shaped this film. Your film is a combination of a straightforward doc that really digs into the gritty part of actually the morgue, everything else, the finding of the body, and it really slams people's heart and their heads if they have an ounce, a shred of humanity in them. But you also have a very beautiful and poetic side of the film as well, and that involves the trip that Gael Garcia Bernal takes, tracing the journey that so many, whether it's the person with the Diane Kristal tattoo or whether it's like thousands, tens of thousands more, millions when it really comes down to it, who have made that same journey. So you have this beautiful combination between the gritty reality in the morgue and in the desert, and then the beauty of the whole trip that's portrayed there as well. Why did you do it that way?
Well, I mean, for several reasons, I think you hit the nail on the head in that part of the trip, even though it's statistically horrific with many people being kidnapped by smugglers and cartels, many people falling from the trains and losing limbs and even their lives, the trains that people travel north on through Mexico, and horrific statistics of up to 6 out of 10 women being raped on that journey. Aside from those statistics, we're on a one-to-one level when we spend time with migrants in all of the different locations, from shelters to river crossings to being on the roof of the train. There is a strong feeling of beauty and hope and solidarity between those people. And the way that we basically set it up in a way that we would turn up at each of these locations with a really, really small crew and ask each of the migrants that we were meeting for advice on how Gael should journey through each of these stages of the journey that the migrants themselves were taking. I think the photographic beauty of that section really comes from the kind of spiritual beauty of a lot of the people that we met. And we wanted to, if you like, contrast that to the silence and the eeriness and the horror of seeing skeletal remains in the morgue, and contrast the literally living part of the journey to the dead part of the journey.
I think you did that really well. And I also think part of it, in terms of this, when you were talking about the invisibleness in terms of the death of the immigrants and what's happening there, and how this is something that really is rarely ever spoken to. But you, in portraying the other side of that, I know I read somewhere where you were talking about contrasting the north to south journey of the body that gets returned, and alongside of that, the south to north of the people going up, you know, so the north to south of the body being returned and the south to north of the people going up. But what you show in that, in addition to what you're saying, you really do sort of find a way that I think very powerfully, you know, I'm thinking about the people sitting on top of the beast, the train that does that, take people for so long, and the kind of camaraderie and the deep feelings that people have for one another. But also you get a sense of the humanity of people who are oftentimes in every way possible denied any sense. We don't get a sense of their humanity, and they're denied any portrayal of humanity.
Yeah, and I mean, it is obviously hugely complex when you're putting the film together, but on a human-to-human level, when you're on the ground actually doing that filming, what I realized was, and maybe, you know, this is something we should all know inherently, there is no difference between those people and us. There is no, if you like, in anthropological terms, the other. When I would return home from some of those filming trips and just be catching up with friends and family back in London, I would explain the experience as I would have made exactly the same decisions as all the people, all the migrants we met on that journey, if I came from a place where I wasn't capable of fulfilling my spiritual hopes and dreams as well as my financial responsibilities to my family. I too would have instantly made the decision to take that journey north. And of course, there are deep economic reasons why certain countries are in poverty and certain countries aren't. Obviously, that relates to, in the case of the US and Central and Latin America, to things like NAFTA or the evolution of the kind of neoliberal economic policies that have kept some countries poor.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Mark Silver, the director of Who is Diane Cristal, and Robin Reinecke, the executive director of the Calibri Center for Human Rights. Robin, let me ask you something here, because before we get away from or get too far into this thing, I want people to understand what it is exactly that you do. Because you made a point in something I read where it says, you said that most of the people who do the kind of work that you do are forensic or physical anthropologists, and that you're a cultural anthropologist, and you think that's extremely important. Explain the difference in what it means in terms of how you seek to identify the dead, and then what does it actually mean? What do you have to go through to identify the dead?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm kind of a rare bird in medical legal world. I'm a social scientist, so the approach that I've taken has really always been towards the social side of identification. So I don't identify remains, only the medical examiner can do that, but what I do and what our team does is we spend a lot of time talking with the families, and we take down detailed information. And a lot of times when you're talking with a family, it does require some cultural sensitivity and a lot of contextual background to understand when people use certain slang words, or you can sense that someone's afraid when they're talking about a particular part of the story, and you can kind of sniff out where there might be more details. And I have found that my training in cultural anthropology helps me navigate the very complex and painful process of basically filing a missing persons report. The other thing that we do is we focus a lot on the item, on the material items that people are carrying, and we try to find out if there is any basically non-scientific clues that can help us find the missing people when we're looking at saint cards or necklaces or jewelry found with the decedents. And I think, moreover, forensic anthropologists, forensic pathologists, medical legal specialists, their focus is really on the dead, and their focus is to get as much data as possible from that one set of unidentified remains. They're really trying to elicit as complete a profile as possible about unidentified remains so that they might be identified. Our side is more helping the family through that process, helping them understand what's going on, what is DNA, what's going to happen next, what does it mean that it's a possible match but not an identification. So it's kind of actually having cultural anthropologists work in this context is not so rare internationally in post-conflict settings, but it is rare domestically. And I think that's another clue that really we're looking at a human rights crisis rather than individual death on an individual kind of more random level.
And let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Mark Silver, the director, filmmaker, and director of a great new film called Who is Diane Kristal, and Robin Reinecke, the executive director of the Colibri Center for Human Rights, and a person who's featured prominently in this film, doing what she's just been talking about, helping to identify this and to basically, I'm thinking about it, Robin, you really do. You're in a position where you have a sense of the horror in every aspect of what it is for the people who die of hypothermia to be an exposure to the climate, to whatever, in the desert, and the horror and terror for the family. I thought it was really very moving when you spoke about that actually it's the terror that people suffer when they don't know what has happened to their loved ones. And you're seeing this all the time throughout the film and all these other things that I've read, some of the work that you've done. The idea that so many thousands have died and how many are still just sort of disappeared and no one knows, their family has no idea what happened to them.
Yeah, the families, they really suffer without information. In this context, as in many others, information becomes medicinal. So we really take that part of our work very, very seriously to do whatever we can to help them find information. But it's what's happening on the border, it's well beyond the numbers of those who've died and disappeared. These are bad deaths. They're difficult deaths. Disappearances are incredibly destructive, not only on a psychological level, but on a social level, on a family level. It's very common to talk with families and hear about the entire family kind of falling apart following a disappearance. It's absolutely devastating. Everybody disagrees about what happened because there's no body, so there's no kind of established boundary to the narrative. It's anthropologically speaking impossible to mourn without the actual physical body. So we take that part of our work seriously to give them this information, as sad as it might be. So many times when we've actually informed a family of the death of a loved one, of the identification, their response has been relief. It's a complicated experience, I think, if you haven't gone through it, but I think anyone can relate to the idea of missing something or missing someone and finally being able to get answers and a resolution.
Mark, let me ask you this. You know, you've made the statement that you would find it very difficult. You didn't set out to, put it that way. You didn't set out to make a balanced film when you approached this subject. Can you talk about that? Because I think, one, I was overjoyed to hear you say that. I think balance is not the question, really. You know, actually, what's the question is the truth of the matter. So I wanted to ask you what you meant when you said you didn't set out to make a balanced film on this subject and how that proceeded.
Without going into like the theory of media studies, so I guess you're almost trained as someone who works in the media to present stories in a balanced way. And just very early on, I mean, I finished university about 10, 12 years ago, and I always felt at that point that I was being taught everything that I kind of didn't want to do. And when I watched things that were apparently balanced, I just felt like they lack a heart or a truth. And also I felt slightly like there was some of those journalists and some of the stories that we studied at that time, it was almost like the illusion of balance. It wasn't something that really inspired me. So from the beginning of when I finished university and then began doing very kind of DIY film projects, I was more interested in getting to, I guess, the truth of the story rather than the balanced point of view over the story. And that led to a whole almost an awakening politically. And at that time, this was in the very, very early days of the internet. So, for example, we were doing some work with an online organization called Indie Media back many years ago. And at demonstrations, for example, against the World Bank and the IMF, people were videoing stuff before the days of YouTube. And then cycle couriers would take it to this secret location in London where they would then upload all of these stories and, in essence, bypassing mainstream media. And in these early stages of my sort of career, looking at the difference between the mainstream media reaction to these events and the people on the ground's reaction to these events, I could see massive differences. And for me, it felt like that kind of what would now be called user-generated content was a much more authentic way of understanding what was going on, in this case on the streets or at big demonstrations. When I looked at the mainstream media's coverage of those similar events, the, in inverted commas, balanced point of view seemed to destroy and erode the truth, or at least what I perceived as my version of the truth. So I think that kind of informed, many years later, the Diani Christel story. And I didn't feel like it was necessary to create a film that had, for want of a better expression, left-wing and right-wing talking head points of view. I felt that that exists already in the media, and you can Google to your heart's content any issue relating to migration. What is lacking is this, the humanization of political agendas. And I felt like when you're standing there in the morgue and looking at many tens of skeletal remains whose voices have very obviously been taken away from them, my motivation at that point was to, if you like, not give voice, but amplify the potential voices those people would have had, as well as trying to create more feeling of empathy. As I said earlier, that feeling of, if I was in that situation, would I have made that same journey? And that felt much more important to me than getting into a very sort of traditional argument over the pros and cons of people coming into the US or not.
Mm-hmm. All right. I have one last question for each of you, and I'll start with you, Robin, but also we have about 5 minutes, no more, but so for both of you. So what I want to pose is, Mark, you had said that you made not a whodunit, but a what happened. And as I was watching the film again this morning, I thought, wow, you know, there's something very, very heavy here. And Robin, you talked about that you are angry about so much attention being focused on the physical border and border security instead of what's happening to the immigrants, to the migrants. And you've taken on very sharply the idea that somehow people dismiss this as, well, they chose to do this. I mean, after all, they didn't have to come here. They chose to go through the desert. They chose all this. I wanted you to talk to this question of choices.
Yeah, it's a very poor excuse to accept hundreds of deaths every year directly following policy. I think we have to start asking, why are hundreds of thousands of people making that same quote-unquote choice and risking their lives crossing an inhospitable desert? And that's really the question that we need to be asking, not why is it that people are breaking this law. Hundreds of thousands of people are breaking the same law, and they're leaving their families, and they're leaving their homes, and they're risking their lives.
Mark, for you, you've also said that the questions between things, and a lot of different things, you've made the point that while you focused on what's happening in the Sonoran Desert, in Arizona, in the southern border of the U.S. and Mexico, you said that, yes, it's happening there and you're focusing there, but you also really gave people a sense, and yourself seem to have a very deep sense of, this is more than just a particular incident or phenomenon in this country. It's something that happens worldwide. And I thought you spoke to that very powerfully. Can you talk to that in terms of it being something bigger than any one incident? And in many ways, as you said, it's a systemic question.
Yeah, it's a massive global problem. And the problem, if you like, the result of that problem is people end up dying at borders, in this case, the Mexico-US desert area. But for me, coming from Europe, we have actually statistically an even bigger problem, like many more thousands of people dying in the Mediterranean Sea for traveling from northern Africa into southern Europe. And again, the systemic way, what they call Fortress Europe, has been designed, forces people to make that journey. And it's been going on for several years. And everybody knows that every week, hundreds more people are dying. And the people that have the power to change that system willingly don't do it. which is exactly the same as what's going on with the so-called corridor of death in the area of the desert that Robin's office has to deal with, with dead migrants. And similarly, between Indonesia and Australia, for example. So when we started off the film, we were never looking, if you like, to make a local story about the Mexico-US border. And if I go all the way back to those first images that we saw of the skull in the desert, we really did look at that as, yes, this is obviously a local story, but the implications are absolutely global. And we could be standing on the shores of islands off the coast of Italy, looking over dead bodies there, and we would pretty much have the same story, the same reasons why people leave home, the same dangers that they have on the journey north, and the same reasons why the system is blocking their entrance, and even worse than blocking, actually forcing them through life-threateningly dangerous areas.
All right, Mark, very powerful film. And Robin, thank you very much. And I want to actually ask you one thing first, Mark, before we leave, is the film is opening in New York. And then it's opening in other parts of the country when?
It's New York and Miami today. And then we have, I think we're just waiting on the other, I think it goes nationwide at some point in the future. And if you go to the website, who is Johnny? crystal.com/screening, you can actually book your own screening locally. And we've got this system through an organization called Gather, where it works in a kind of crowd sourcing way that if you can get enough people you know to the cinema locally will put on the film.
So that's dianicristal.com.
Who is dianicristal?
Who is dianicristal.com and /screenings?
Yeah.
Okay, great. And Robin, can you tell people how they can find out more about the work that you do?
Yes, we're online at colibricenter.org, and we're also on Facebook, and you can follow us there for news and more information.
All right, Mark, Robin, thank you very much for joining us today.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Sure, and thank you for a great, great film, one that is not to be missed, folks. Get to this film. It's going to change your head. It's going to really change your head. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have been talking with Mark Silver, documentary filmmaker based in London, about his first feature-length film, Who is Diane Cristal, and Robin Reinecke, co-founder and executive director of the Colibri Foundation for Human Rights. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be speaking with two of the actors from a brand new piece. It's the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess. So stay tuned, all right? Welcome back. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and that was Miles Davis. It was Miles Davis in collaboration with Gil Evans, and it was a recording they did of the music from the Gershwin brothers, Porgy and Bess. All right, and they did that in 1959, and it was a studio album. It's one of the mono recordings that they're really a fabulous collection. But the thing that's really important about this is Miles Davis and Gil Evans created, in their recording of this, they created one of the most profound and just stunning interpretations of the Gershwin Brothers' music from Porgy and Bess. And that song in particular is Summertime, and Summertime is one of the most covered songs in the entire world. Okay, I think that there's more than 30,000 covers of that song, and it's one of the backbone songs from the Gershwin Brothers' Porgy and Bess. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. There's a touring production of the Gershwin Brothers' Porgy and Bess that is going all over the country. It's been a lot of places, and it still has a lot of places to go. And I just happened to be lucky enough to catch a performance of it the other night, and I was just amazed. Just again, just totally stunned. All right, it was just a very, very powerful, very beautiful piece. And for those of you who don't know the story of Porgy and Bess, let me say a little bit about it.
When Porgy and Bess premiered on a New York stage in 1935, nobody could have ever predicted the impact it would have, its reach, nor the indelible impact on the American psyche and culture, nor its persistently shifting position within that culture. And that was a comment from essayist Linnell George, who recently wrote about this touring production of the Gershwin Brothers' Porgy and Bess. Conceived and composed as an opera, Porgy and Bess has been staged internationally in scores of versions. Now, re-envisioned as a musical stage production, the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess is touring the U.S., as I said. The Gershwin's Porgy and Bess portrays the lives of black people set in the 1920s in Charleston's fabled Catfish Row, where the beautiful Bess struggles to break free from her scandalous past. The only one who can rescue her is the courageous Porgy. Threatened by her formidable former lover, Crown, and the seductive enticements of the colorful troublemaker's sporting life, Porgy and Bess's relationship evolves into a deep romance that triumphs as one of theater's most exhilarating love stories. Joining us to talk about all this today are the cast members Alicia Hall Moran, who plays Bess, and Kingsley Leggs, who plays Sporting Life in the touring production of Gershwin's Porgy and Bess.
And we're talking, our guests today are Alicia Hall Moran, who plays Bess and does a really tremendous job, and Kingsley Leggs, who plays Sporting Life. I gotta tell you, man. That is one of the most complicated characters I've seen in a long time. There's so much to talk about in this, and I'm really looking forward to it. I guess one of the things, as I've been saying, it's artistically, emotionally, it's had a long and powerful and sometimes controversial impact on this country. And as I was saying, when the reason I picked that Miles piece from Summertime, and it really, think about this, 30,000 covers yeah. of this, mm-hmm. you know, but you think about the impact this has had on the cultural fabric, not in the mainstream cultural fabric and so much, but in the fabric that actually tells the story of the people's lives, mm-hmm. you know, and in particular, it tells the story of black people's lives in yeah. this country. And the fight that's going on around that for the respect, for the recognition, all of this, you know. And I wanted to know what drew each of you to this. And we can start with you, Alicia, because you are Bess, and you knocked me out. I got to tell you, you just knocked me out.
That was my intention.
Yeah, I knew it. So go ahead. What brought you to this?
Well, for me, I have to say the creative team of Diane Paulus, Pulitzer Prize winning playwright Susan Laurie Parks, incredible musician, jazz improviser, band leader, composer Deidre Murray, and the choreographer Ron Brown. Those were all four artists I was already aware of. And the idea that they would come together at all on anything is already captivating enough. You know, I would be buying a ticket. I would be in that audience. I would be interested. I'm the audience for those people. But then that they would look at a classic and then something like Porgy and Bess within that. This is original English language, original, that New York immigration story. This is Jewish culture meeting black culture. This is an urban look at a rural community. It's a part of the history. I mean, it was, I would say, irresistible. And that they were going to play a little bit with some of the sonic world inside of that, which for me as a singer means the vocal areas. You know, I'm going to get to use my head voice. I'm going to get to use my chest voice. I'm going to tell you what I know about different areas of African-American spirit and good times in the music. This is like chance of a lifetime. Mm-hmm. Chance and of a lifetime.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's amazing the impact that it has on people. Kingsley, you.
I would have to say also the opportunity to work with all this extraordinary creative team that was assembled for this. I was in another show when they were developing this show at ART, but I kind of followed all the articles. And
ART is?
American Repertory Theater in Boston, right?
Mm-hmm. Cambridge.
In Cambridge, yes, where they were started this piece. But I kind of paid attention to all the articles and paid attention to the journey of it as it was moving towards coming to Broadway. I auditioned for the show many, many years ago, back in the 80s. My first New York audition. I was a young pup and very intimidated, but very excited about the prospect of just being a part of this story. I had seen a production of the opera in St. Louis, and I just love the story. I think what really I love about it is the humanity of it. And it's very rare now to see African-American stories on stage that are authentic and visceral and alive in the way that this piece is. And then you join that with an incredible Gershwin score and all the history and legacy of this piece, all the artists who have come through this piece and played these roles. It's a dream to be in this show, to be a part of this.
Yeah, and the social reality of it's a fight. It's a fight.
This thing. It's about all these issues are, they're still issues. People still have these problems. People still go through, you know what I mean? It's about the human spirit and what makes us tick, why we function, why we move and breathe and do what we do.
I want to remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with two of the cast members from the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess. We're speaking with Alicia Hall Moran, who plays Bess, and Kingsley Leggs, who plays Sporting Life. When you're thinking about Porgy and Bess, people can always have some minor reference point in relation to that, because that's how well-known the thing is in terms of whether so many people have seen it or not. Because in this country, it's sort of weird. It's like opera has been something that's removed from the people, right. You know, and has a rarefied audience. But then part of what actually I thought was really cool about this is it tried to bridge that gap. It tried to say, we're going someplace else. And I wanted to ask you this, because the synthesis that's going on, the meshing, these different flavors, this is something you rarely see. You were saying this, Alicia, about that this combines so much in terms of musical forms. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got jazz, blues, prayer songs, you know, all kinds of work songs. You've got all mm-hmm. kinds of things. I mean, there's that scene in part of it where it reminded me of Oscar Brown's stories at the Chicago mm-hmm. alleys, you know, when they have the strawberry guy coming out and all this stuff right. in the
yeah.
play.
Yeah.
But so let's talk about that. How challenging was that? Or how was it challenging or liberating in that you got to mess around with this particular mesh of form?
I think for me, the really well-used idea in dramatic arts that you have to be in the moment clears all the confusion, I think, really. You are in the moment. So Susan Laurie and Diane Paulus point to the moments so clearly, because they're also using less of the incidental music of Porgy and Bess. There's no children's chorus. There's certain buzzard song, the singing about this ominous bird does not happen. All kinds of like colorful touches. We're getting to the song about raising the body of Robbins up into heaven. We're getting to It Ain't Necessarily So. Kingsley singing to, or Sportin' Life singing to Bess to allure her away from the security of the central town. We're getting to Bess, you is my woman now, Porgy professing his love. We do all of the arias in full. Summertime gets reiterated about three times. It was a hit then, it's a hit now. They're not cutting out any of that. They want the, you know, all the hits are there. But it's how they're strung together, I think, is really fascinating for people, because they try to make all of the balances really clear. So I think that where the music has you're doing chromatics down, like, you know, you can do this in a Mozartean fashion. Gershwin knew about Mozart. You can like, you know, you can blues it, and my voice sounds incredibly creepy at this time of
no it doesn't.
I love it.
You know, whatever. But I'm not shy about, you know, the phases of my voice through the day. So, you know, you can bring a blues into, you can do blue notes, you can emphasize. So, like, I think the musical education that you come with as an actor to the stage, and they were very careful to make it a diverse set of musical educations at play. All of them good, all of them bona fide. But people and their own resonance and where their voice lives, they're going to find different places. The woman who mourns for the man who gets killed in the little fist fight up at the top of the show, she's an operatic soprano. This is a Mimi, you know, a Violetta. And she is going to bring some of what you hear in the opera that you love, like the black classical soprano tradition. This is rich, full, must have clarity, a good diction, and a real element of truth and being grounded to the bottom. Where is Brother Robbins? About three octaves up from what I just did. You know, but then, like, you're going to want something different from some of the other down and dirtier characters. And the show is just cast so well for that. And what's so great is that Gershwin in his time heard these voices. He knew these people. He understands the genius of Cab Calloway. He understands the genius of Anne Brown, the classical, or the soprano who originated the role of Bess. This is an ear and a compositional mind that understands. And also, I really have to keep reiterating the Jewish folk element in it and the religious tradition of that. That's a very literate tradition. So, you know, I really love that connection that he would be the writer of one of the more frequently done stories about Black people, because it gives us a kind of like a scribe kind of quality to what we are doing. It is repeatable. It is patterned, just like African music is patterned. But it's kind of coming through this Jewish, Germanic, Russian thing, you know, it's like very organized and Western music theory, but we are also a part of that world. We're Western people here in the United States. So I'm really rambling, but I just want to try to really get it through that I'm not functioning on any kind of like stereotype.
Right, no,
that's clear. Really functioning on the cultural lightning rods and the signals, the like, Those fighting words, well, I can't fight you in this voice. You have to go to a different place. Mm-hmm. And you cannot make love in a certain other kind of voice. I'll have to bring you to another place. Mm-hmm. So we're going to travel those voices together. People think in the show and they listen. It's like a pin could drop in our audience every night.
Oh,
it is incredible.
And that's the greatest compliment of all, to hear silence and to feel people's attentiveness. Yeah.
I want to remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with two of the cast members from the Gershwins' Porgy and Bess. We're speaking with Alicia Hall Moran, who plays Bess, and Kingsley Leggs, who plays Sporting Life. One of the things that Susan Laurie Parks did to this version of Porgy and Bess was that she gave the characters more fullness, you know, in the sense of she gave the different parts. She had this thing of backstories, for instance. She said she wanted to develop this so that you knew what actually was behind Bess, what shaped Bess, what was the fullness of her thought. And Kingsley, I have to say with your character too, you know, I was so torn about your character because I sort of looked at it as you did a great job, right? You did a great job because every time you came on, you could feel the audience go, but then you feel like they know there's going to be something that's kind of cool and kind of sharp that comes out. But at the same time, you're recognizing, so you're developing a likeness for your character. You're doing it very well, but then you're also doing it very well because people are also like, wait a minute, this guy seems to be something like just shy of being a pimp, perhaps is one, is a dope dealer, and but somebody who also recognizes it reminded me of somebody who's like, you look in the society today, where somebody who recognizes the overall, you know, horror of the society, but is finding a way through. Unfortunately, it's a way that preys on people.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, he's definitely unsavory. I mean, there's no question about that. But I think that's what's interesting, because he's not just unsavory. He's smart. He's calculating. He's dangerous. And because of all of that, yes, it makes him dangerous. And the way, and he has a facility to move and come in and out of Catfish Row and in effect Catfish Row. Mm-hmm. And he's directly responsible for her downfall. Mm-hmm. But I find it really fun to play that and to walk that tightrope. Because there is a lot of life in sport, he's sporting life.
Exactly.
And so he does bring life and fun to Catfish Row. But
he's not kind of what ends up getting portrayed with Crown, who's the other person who's sort of the other bad guy in the thing, who actually looked at as, in the point that it's the rape scene, the whole thing of the whole way that this guy is just exercising this horrific control over your character, Alicia, you know, over Bess. Now, Kingsley, one of the things I wanted to say, too, though, is, you know, your character reminded me, particularly with Ain't Necessarily So, which I really liked because it was a great take on the Bible and everything else. And I'm an atheist, okay? And I love the point that you get up in there and you're saying this stuff. But it reminded me, too, it was like you were like that little hot stuff devil, right? Which was something that was funny, but it was like, wait a minute, still a devil with a pitchfork. Okay.
I want to remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with two of the cast members from the Gershwins' Porgy and Bess. We're speaking with Alicia Hall Moran, who plays Bess, and Kingsley Leggs, who plays Sporting Life.
I wanted to ask you guys this question, too, because we're talking about the influences on this and the Gullah people and the choreography. That stuff was stunning. That funeral scene was one of the most amazing scenes I've ever seen. And you want to talk about something that grabbed people and had people just bam, right, locked on the stage.
Yeah.
And that just the position of the people doing it.
Yeah.
Well, in this production, everyone does dance. You know, there's not a separate chorus of dancers. We are the moving parts. And the process that Ron Brown requires of you in the rehearsal period, it's intense and full-bodied, literally.
Yeah.
So you begin, you flex your toes, you move your head, you get right to the ground. Someone in the... We had a question and answer session with the audience at the... was it at the Amundsen or in the last city we were in? Oh, Las Vegas.
It was Vegas.
And somebody asked a wonderful question about the dancing. They had been very moved. And some, was it Dwelvin David or Nkrumah Gatlin? Somebody said in the cast, oh, yeah, you know. Ron's like, hey, how you doing? Okay, everybody get on the ground. That was it.
But that's pretty much it.
Yeah. You're going to get down.
Yeah.
And then showing you where the African, and with throughout the diaspora, because he's, you know, traveled to so many countries in Africa and then across the Caribbean and the United States. So he's like an encyclopedia of movement and meaning. And he...
And his family is Gullah as well.
Right? Hmm. Really?
Are they?
Are they?
He's from Brooklyn.
Really?
Did they come from Uganda?
Well, I'm not sure. Well, I thought that I'd ever come. I don't, could be.
That's
maybe
a,
not.
It's a good thing for me to Google.
Because I thought I remembered him saying he went and spent some time down there.
He did do that.
I thought he said he had some family down there.
That's fascinating. I think, though, what you're talking about with authenticity and a feeling, so African dance, it's communal.
Yeah.
So it's in the ring. Everything's in the circle. It's in the ring. So the audience is the other half of that ring. So when we're doing the movements properly, you are to feel you are part of it. This is clapping. That's not like clap, 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 clap in your front. This is like 360-degree movement of the arms in a circle to the front of you, and then bring it all the way back to your belly low and get it. And you come with your chest. Mm-hmm. You come with your torso, your pelvis. Your knees have to bend. So if in the audience you can't feel that, you're in a... No, I don't know where you at. You need to get out of there.
Well, none of it's arbitrary. There's no movement for movement's sake. It's
not
all
at
has...
All.
Specific meaning and reverence and connection of that culture and that group of people to God, to the earth, and to the source of life.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing arbitrary.
Yeah, you know, and I have to say that comes through in your performances. And, you know, one of the things when you were talking about this, one of the things I found that I didn't know, I mean, look, because, you know, growing up, I remember seeing the movie and going, oh, I don't know, it's like, you know, whatever, how old I was, I was just a baby.
That was Susan Laurie's response also
on
the first day of rehearsal. She was like, I saw that movie. I was like, hell no. And that's a quote.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, yes, you have company there.
Yeah. And what I saw the other night is just such a huge leap. I mean, it's a quantum leap beyond that. And I think it's important because there is a point about the popularization of this work in particular. And the popularization of the art form itself. But the way it became, I thought there was, I guess Diane Paulus said that she talked to Gershwin's estate and they said, look, the opera's going to live. It's established. It's going to live forever. Mm-hmm. What we need is something that's going to bust it out so that all kinds of people will be attracted to see it. And I kept thinking about one thing I found, and we only have about a minute and a half. So one of the things, I know it goes quick.
That's really fast.
One of the things that I found was that in South Africa, and I had been to South Africa during apartheid. I was writing about the struggle against apartheid there. Mm. And in the 70s, they tried to perform it. Some people tried to perform it, and who knows what it would have been then. But they weren't allowed to do it. But later in the 90s, they performed it, and they performed it in Cape Town. But it was based on the life of the people in Soweto. Mm. And they said it was such a fit. You know, so they didn't dramatically change the content, but it was just there was a universality to this that is really important, I think. So
yes,
okay. Yeah, I think that's part of why it's lasted so long.
Mm-hmm.
It always comes back to the humanity. It always comes back to the same thing.
Mm-hmm. And that's a big question today. Look, that the humanity, and just to be frank, the big question, the humanity of Black people in America, that's something that I don't think should be up for debate. But when you look at what happens with Trayvon Martin, when you look at what happens with Jordan Davis, these people who are, you know, people, it's okay to kill people. It's okay to kill Black people. That's what comes across in the courts. And we're talking about mass incarceration here. You know, you look at this. We have to, this play really adds to the fabric of society that's saying, no, we're not going to allow this anymore. So you guys are damn good in doing this. I think it's really important. So thank you very much for being here and for doing the play as well.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
This was a pleasure.
And I want to remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have been talking just now with two of the performers from Gershwin's Porgy and Bess. And it's touring around the country still, right, after this? So, yeah. You guys are never ending, right? There you go.
From your mouth to God.
There you go.
Right, can you please tell the people to come and hear my evening voice?
It's beautiful.
This voice knocked you out now.
You're
going to love the nighttime voice. It wraps itself around your spine. It really does. It's a tremendous, tremendous performance. We've been talking with Alicia Hall Moran, who plays Bess and does a really beautiful job with it, and Kingsley Leggs, who plays Sport in Life, who I got to tell you, like I said, Hot Stuff, I always went for that comic book first. I really, really liked that, and I thought you brought just the right edge to that character.
No, thank you so
much.
Yeah,
it was really, really important. So, all right, well, that just about brings us to the end of another show. But before we go, I want to read you something from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and this is taken from his book, Basics. And this is linked to what we were talking about in the first half of the show with Mark Silver and Robin Reinecke, talking about the immigrants forced to come here from all over the world, but especially from Central America and Mexico, coming here, many of them dying in the desert as they struggle to get here, facing arrest and deportation, terrible exploitation when they are able to stay here. This is the life of immigrants. And so for many people, they talk about, well, they chose to do this, as we were talking about in the interview. And I wanted to read you this statement from Bob Avakian. Now, I can just hear these reactionary fools saying, well, Bob, answer me this. If this country is so terrible, why do people come here from all over the world? Why are so many people trying to get in and not get out? Why? I'll tell you why. Because you have fucked up the rest of the world even worse than you have done in this country. You've made it impossible for many people to live in their own countries as part of gaining your riches and power. Again, that's from Bob Avakian. And it's originally taken from the film Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And you can access that film at revolutiontalk.net. And you can also check out Avakian's latest film at revcom.us. And that film is Revolution, Nothing Less, BA Speaks. Revcom.us is where you're going to be able to check out the revolution, all right? Check out the revolution, find out what you think about it and where you can fit in. That's revcom.us. I want to thank all of my guests today, Mark Silver, Robin Reinecke, and Alicia Hall Moran and Kingsley Leggs. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my board up for today, Federico Garcia. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. All right, we're going to go out now with a very special song from the band Outer National. And this song is called Across the Borderline. And it features in its opening few verses, it features the voice of Bob Avakian. All right, so this is Across the Borderline from Outer National. Talk to you again next week.
There's a land, so I've been told. Every street is paved with gold, and it's just across the borderline. And when it's time to take your turn, here's a lesson you must learn. You will lose more than you'll ever hope to find.